The following is the story of the evolution of a nature writer. Chris Bolgiano first published what she called ungodly dull academic articles that got her tenured at JMU. Then she promptly decided to work part-time. After a couple of residential stops in small valley towns and getting a few more articles published, Chris and her husband moved out to their very own 100-acre wood in the wilds of Folks Run. They first lived in a tent, then in a very old trailer, and then moved into a house that they themselves had built. And all the while, Chris Bolgiano was writing.
I decided to write about what I wanted to know, and what I wanted to know was the history of the forest in this area. We live on the border of the George Washington National Forest, which is 1.1 million acres of recovering wildland. And I didn't really know anything about it, so I started to delve into that history. And I learned some incredible things. It hurts me that so many people locally do not understand where our national forests came from. They came from the destruction by hundreds of private timber companies through unregulated logging. Even one of my good friends, who's descended from one of the families that was kicked out of Shenandoah National Park, he read my book, The Appalachian Forest, and he's a wonderful outdoorsman. He's a hunter. He's a birder. And yet he said to me, I had no clue. I thought these forests were ancient. But on the contrary, our forests here are in some ways pitiful remnants of what they were before about 1880. There was that big holocaust of logging that went through between 1880 and 1930. And the national forests came about because so many people pressured Congress to pass the Weeks Act of 1911, which authorized the Forest Service to purchase land in the east for national forests. Without that, I'm not sure what would have happened. 100 years ago, if you stood on one of the hills on JMU's campus and looked west, you would have seen lines of smoke from all the fires, all the wildfires. Fighting fires was one of the Forest Service's biggest first tasks. So I felt it was important for people to understand what we had lost. If you don't know what you've lost, you're never going to be able to get it back again. And I think that's very relevant to management of the national forest today. The timbering, the road building, the possibility of fracking for natural gas in the national forests, these are all pretty scary to me, considering that they are still very much recovering.
When you talk about recovering, what does that mean to you?
Well, first of all, of course, the regrowth of trees. But as part of that, you have that whole sequence of trees growing up, dropping their leaves, which replenish the soil. As the trees grow older and grow more mature, they become more complex. If they're left alone, after 150 years or so, they begin to develop old growth characteristics. Old growth is a favorite topic of mine, and it's a very poor name. I just wish they'd name it something different. It seems to indicate dead, decaying, dying trees and forests, but it's actually almost exactly the opposite. Old growth is the natural state of our southern Appalachian forests. Trees can grow easily to 600, 800 years old. As they grow, their bark becomes very wrinkled and craggy, kind of like my face as I get older. The difference being that my face isn't going to be hosting hundreds of species of fungi, mosses, insects, and so on, like old bark will. Old trees become, you know, the canopies become very complex. So there's lots of structure to house wildlife. And the ultimate recovery is to regain those wildlife species that were forced out. We almost lost black bears completely. There were something like 6 estimated left in Shenandoah National Park. Deer were completely gone. Deer tracks were so rare in the 30s, 20s and 30s, people would call all their neighbors to come and see a deer track when they saw it. When I write, there's basically 2 forms of research. One, of course, is book research, which is essential. But the other part is talking to experts out in the field. And I always try to have both of those because they don't necessarily agree. Mm-hmm. You know, the knowledge or the data that you find in published materials might be on the cusp of change when you go out to talk to, you know, an expert in the field. So I try to, you know, get both those perspectives.
You've got a book out. You've written a lot of articles. Did you feel that you were having a career here?
As a writer?
As a writer.
Gosh, I can't say I've ever thought of myself, maybe until recently, as a writer. Aspiring writer would be more like it, you know.
What happened recently?
Well, this is my sixth book now. And so I guess if I'm not a writer now, what would I be? I mean, I don't even know what I'd call myself.
Six books, Chris. I think it's allowed. I'm sitting here looking at your latest book, which is a coffee table sized book from University of North Carolina Press. And it's called Southern Appalachian Celebration in Praise of Ancient Mountains, Old Growth Forests, and Wilderness. And it's beautiful photographs. And you write the text.
Yes.
How did this book come about?
Well, 16 or 17 years ago, I met long distance a photographer named James Valentine. Mm-hmm. We were introduced by a mutual friend, a forester, Bob Zahner, very well known in North Carolina. I had been writing about old growth. I think that I might be the first person to have written about eastern old growth. I had a 1989 article published in American Forests called something like Eastern Old Growth. The idea being at that time that that terrible Holocaust of timbering from 1880 to 1930 that went through our mountains. My idea about old growth at that time was that we could have new old growth. In fact, that might have been the name of the article, New Eastern Old Growth, with the idea being that the trees that were growing back up on the national forests after that, you know, pillaging in the early 19th century were reaching maturity. And at this time, Western old growth was being very heavily researched. You know, there was the spotted owl controversy and so on. Ecologists out west were identifying certain kinds of characteristics of old growth, like the way the canopy looked and the complexity of structure and undisturbed soil, that kind of thing. And so looking at our forests, I was thinking, well, if these trees aren't disturbed, they could, over the next century or two, begin to develop those characteristics. So anyway, so that's what I was writing about.
Your trees in Folks Run.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And across the border in the national forest.
Yes.
And so this forester, Bob Zahner from North Carolina, called me when he read that article, and we struck up a wonderful relationship. Well, he had known Jim Valentine since Jim was a boy growing up in North Carolina. So when Jim started talking about doing some old growth photos, Bob introduced him to me. As I say, long distance. This was before JPEGs. First, Jim sent me slides, you know. Then we graduated to email. Well, I never met Jim until last fall.
Kidding.
At the book release. No, we collaborated for 15 years before we ever met. And I'm happy to say he's just as eccentric as any artist could be.
Hooray!
Yes, I was very happy. He's a great guy.
So what we have is a series of photographs that to me made me feel that I was in the forest, and a text that just augments that feeling. So how did you two work together?
Jim spent, I don't know, 20 years hiking hundreds of miles, mostly in national forests, from Virginia, West Virginia, down through Alabama, all through the southern Appalachians to get these pictures. And he came to me with his photos already organized into seven chapters: thinking biodiversity, thinking like a mountain, thinking like a forest, thinking like a bald, thinking like a waterway, thinking like a sacred place. Of course, this is a spinoff from Aldo Leopold, the great American conservationist and writer, who in 1949 published what probably is his most famous essay, Thinking Like a Mountain. Leopold wrote that essay after he watched all the deer in the Southwest, certain parts of the Southwest, just explode in population because he and other rangers had killed off all the wolves and other predators, thinking that with no predators, the deer would be safe. Well, they were so safe that they exploded in population. They ate the habitat down to where I don't believe today it even supports as many deer as it did before the wolves were taken off. And so Jim took that same holistic perspective and applied it to all those things that are characteristic of the Southern Appalachians. For example, biodiversity. The Southern Appalachians are globally recognized as the most biodiverse temperate woodlands in the world. No place in the world has more native life forms in that temperate climate zone than Great Smoky Mountains National Park. That's pretty remarkable. And the Altaxa biological inventory that's currently going on in Great Smoky Mountains National Park, so far they have identified over 17,000 species, almost 1,000 of which are totally new to science, have never been known before, and they estimate something like 60,000 left to go. Now, of course, many of these are soil organisms, water bears, springtails, mites, you
They're
know.
All important.
Like E.O. Wilson says, Dr. E.O. Wilson, probably the most famous biologist in the world, he calls these uncharismatic little species, quote, the little things that run the world.
Okay. Mr. Valentine presents you with a series of photos organized into seven chapters. What is your mission if you choose to accept it?
The title of the book is Celebration, Southern Appalachian Celebration. He wanted people to understand and celebrate this incredible diversity of life here and to appreciate it because he felt that once people understand it and appreciate it, they will be more likely to protect it. He wanted a lot of Cherokee lore in there. Well, for one of my books, The Appalachian Forest, I had been down to Quala Boundary in North Carolina and had interviewed the forester there and spent some time there. So I had a little background in that.
You want to fill us in on Quala Boundary?
Quala Boundary is the Eastern Cherokee Reservation, something like 56,000 acres, I believe, where the handful of descendants from people that had escaped from the Trail of Tears in 1838, I don't know, maybe 100 or 200 Cherokees, no one really knows how many, hid out in the mountains for some decades and slowly began to establish their rights to the land and so today, Quala Boundary is the Eastern Cherokee Reservation.
So you are supporting and understanding what he is doing. And then how do you start writing?
Always, I start with the research. And people ask me, have you been to all these places? I haven't been to all of them, but I've been to a good many of them. And so I had some personal experience to draw on. But basically, I didn't want to tell people, okay, you're looking at a cherry tree. I mean, I wanted to tell them more than that. And so I just picked out whatever I could latch onto in the picture to tell the greater story of the biodiversity in the Southern Appalachians and to bring in both the natural history and the human history. One example is Jim has a lovely picture of a chestnut oak in there. It's one of the big trees. It's a single trunk, you know, large tree, beautiful photograph. Well, in my experience, a single trunk chestnut oak is actually fairly uncommon because in the northern part of the Southern Apps, from Virginia down into North Carolina, chestnut oaks were highly valued for tan bark. People would cut the trees, skim off the bark, leave the tree laying in the woods but take the bark out, and leach tannic acid from the bark to use in tanning leather. Chestnut trees are one of the best hardwood stump sprouters. You know, you cut them and they'll put up a lot of sprouts. Not all trees do that, but chestnut oaks are very good at that. So I find on my property and in the National Forest, I've hiked through thousands of acres of multiple stem chestnut oaks cut during the 1910, you know, teens, 20s, 30s for bark. And they put up the multiple trunks. There weren't enough deer to eat them down. So I find chestnut oaks with 5, 6, 7, 8 multiple trunks. Finding one with a single trunk struck me as relatively unusual. So that's one of those nerdy nuances of forest history and forest ecology. People go in the woods today and they'll see, you know, a great big tree with 7 huge trunks. Well, they think nothing of it. But I know that tree was cut for tan bark a century or more ago.
Find the big single trunk chestnut oak. And that looks like it. All right. And read what you wrote.
Okay. Well, this is a chestnut oak. It's 39.4 inches in diameter at breast height. This one happens to be in Pisgah National Forest in North Carolina. In some parts of the Southern Appalachians, it's uncommon to find a chestnut oak with a single trunk, like hemlocks and American chestnuts, which is a separate species whose leaves are similar to chestnut oaks. Chestnut oaks have tannic acid in their bark that used to be leached to tan leather. Many chestnut oaks in the Southern Appalachians were harvested a century ago for their bark only. The stumps sprouted readily into multiple strong trunks, unlike most conifers and many other hardwoods.
Very nice. It's a tree with a story, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any sense of what you know or understand about life and the pursuit of happiness? I don't know if liberty comes into it, but the pursuit of happiness from your years of living in the wilds and writing about the wilds that maybe the rest of us are missing.
Well, it's certainly been an education in rural life. I've gotten to know people that live on the land in Falks Run, and it's been a great privilege and a great pleasure. I don't think you can be an honest environmental writer without taking into consideration the people who live in the environment. And so I've been very happy and very grateful to become part of the Falks Run community and get to know people who actually live on the land.
You'll find a photograph of one of those multiple trunk chestnut oaks, as well as a link to Chris Bolgiano's website on the Spark page at WMRA.org.